ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I think it was when I went to the doctor and did some blood tests because I just kept getting sick and run down. And those tests came back showing I had really high cholesterol.
This is Caitlin Marshall. At the time, she was in her early 20s and working in sexual assault crisis support. And getting these results was a huge surprise.
I was pretty sporty and fit, and doctor said, you're probably going to have to go on medication for the rest of your life to keep your cholesterol down, and you need to, you know, cut out all the alcohol and junk food that you're consuming. And I was like, I'm not consuming that. So I suppose that was a moment that really stuck out, that I was like, what is going on with me?
And soon after that, Caitlin started getting sharp, intense chest pains.
The doctors couldn't find anything. So, yeah, that was a really big moment of me feeling really scared. And I thought something was seriously wrong with my physical health. And it wasn't until I was encouraged to go and see a different GP who was actually also a doctor of Chinese medicine. And he was asking me all these questions about my job and my work. And I was kind of thinking, well, what's that got to do with it? And he said to me, you know, your heart is hurting. You are carrying the pain of all these women that you're working with, and it's not yours to carry.
Light bulb moment. Caitlin's body was screaming out at her that her work was impacting her from the inside out. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and welcome to a special 5-part series on This Working Life, all about your health at work. Now, Caitlin realised, even though her boss had said, have boundaries in your work, she didn't know how to do that. Having little control over your high job demands can be a dangerous combination. It's called job strain, and its impact can be, well,
I would describe it as huge.
In this first instalment of our Health Focus series, we're digging into exactly what job strain is and who's taking responsibility for it.
First off, I wasn't really aware of it because it kind of happens slowly over time. And in this case, it did with me. You know, it's the kind of accumulation effect.
What you don't hear workplaces talking about are the work-based causes of that.
And of course, we'll explore what we can do about it.
The challenge is that for every solution needs to be context relevant.
You'll hear more from Caitlin Marshall later in the episode about what she's doing today. But first, I'd like you to meet Professor Tony LaMontagna.
Professor of Work, Health and Wellbeing from the Institute for Health Transformation at Deakin University and also in the School of Health and Social Development there.
Tony, I was really interested in this idea of job strain. What is job strain?
Okay, so job strain describes a combination of two working conditions, the demands you have in your job and also the level of control you have over your job. So demands can be anything from cognitive demands or quantitative demands, physical demands, or even emotional demands. So for workers in caring professions, for example, a social worker, a nurse, a physician, emotional demands, as you could imagine intuitively, are pretty high, whereas for a construction laborer, it'd be more of a physical demand issue. So demands can take various forms. And then control is about how much decision latitude, how much you're able to decide how to do your work. Autonomy is another word for job control, job autonomy. You know, so can you decide the order in which you do your tasks or how you approach the work? Do you get to use a variety of different skills in doing your work? And the higher the control you have, the better for your mental health and well-being and also physical health.
Tony, have you yourself ever experienced job strain?
Oh, yes. So we have to go deep into my job history, to my early working years. So for example, after high school, I didn't go straight to university. I was thinking about becoming a carpenter, and I went to work for a general contractor that I knew through my neighbor, and I had worked there on weekends during high school. And so the promise was that I would learn some carpentry skills, but that never happened. I was in a job strain job with low control and high physical demands, and, you know, with little opportunity to learn. And this is another sort of aspect of skill discretion. So if you're not able to do a variety of things, it's more of a monotonous job. And that's sort of mind-numbing and can be lead to alienation and poor mental health. And so that year of working as a construction laborer for me was my experience of job strain.
And how did that end up for you? Were you okay in the end?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was okay in the end. The way that job ended was I walked away. I said, well, you're not teaching me anything. You know, well, to get back to work. Well, no, I quit. No, you can't quit. You're fired. It was one of those discussions. Everybody's had one of those, I think. Yeah. So anyway, I just moved on and I decided, well, maybe I will go to uni after all. It's sort of a non-traditional path to professorship, but that's where it ended. But, you know, it's interesting when you study this kind of thing, it's quite valuable to have some real world perspective on it as well. And of course, in all of what we do in mental health practice and policy these days, lived experiences is now highly valued. That's a relatively new thing. And a good thing. The perspectives of people living with mental illness are quite important to understanding, well, what can we do and how should we do it?
So let's go meta on job strain. Do we know how common it is in Australia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite common. So up to a quarter of working people will be in a job strain situation. In Europe, it's about the same. But importantly, women are much more exposed to job strain than men because of a persistent discrepancy in job control between men and women. Even women in the same job as a man will tend to have lower control, and that's persisting sexism in the workplace.
Mm. Are there any other trends when it comes to industries that may be more susceptible to having higher levels of job strain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if you look across the occupational skill levels or occupational status, if you will, at the top are managers, professionals, CEOs. At the bottom are laborers, for example. And in between, we have teachers, we have clerical trades, skilled trades, things like this. So there's a scale from 1 to 9, basically. And job control patterns neatly along that scale. So you can imagine a CEO has relatively high autonomy. That CEO might have very high demands, but that's offset by high job control. And at the bottom, you know, you have the highest prevalence of job strain. At the top, you have the lowest.
So my experience with job strain usually comes from working in a corporate environment. Hi, my name is Ryan McCrory and I'm the founder of Exona. It's probably more noticeable whenever I get to the end of the year and I'd look back and just say, geez, I was having a real rough time there, or I feel pretty burnt out. Why was that happening? And I think it was because of being generally fatigued by high kind of demand of the roles that I was in. So a level of responsibility. And a lot of that I put on myself, my own high expectations of what I wanted to achieve. But then I think part of it is just the culture of how we work. So really my role has been to measure or research employee well-being, design solutions, and then measure their effectiveness. They know something's happening. It might be, you know, they've got really high absenteeism, or their turnover is really poor, or they're finding it hard to attract people, or they've done an engagement survey and people are saying well-being is not scoring too good, but I'm not really sure what's contributing to that. So it's kind of our job to go in there and kind of observe their environment and chat to people, chat to the executive team, kind of find out what they're doing.
And Ryan thinks that there are two types of job strain, intentional and unintentional.
I think intentional job strain could be considered where a work environment or job design intentionally places high demands on employees with, you know, limited control or support, is maybe a misguided attempt to increase productivity or enforce discipline or maybe even due to poor management practices. So I think this is, and examples of this might include, you know, setting excessively high performance targets without providing adequate resources or support, or deliberately limiting autonomy or decision-making power as a control measure in some cases. I think the unintentional side of things is where, you know, high or low low control are really not deliberate outcomes of the way organizations roll or how they practice stuff. So I think this is really due to the some cases we see it where organizations have had rapid change inadvertently increases workloads for periods of time. Maybe it's a lack of understanding from leadership or management on how operational decisions affect employee stress. That's probably the one we see most common. And then other things such as communication, how decisions are made and how that impacts people and places, you know, a level of emotional or cognitive demands on those at the tail end of those decisions.
And the cumulative effects of all these individual workers' health ailments, what is that impact on our organisations and our society?
Well, I would describe it as huge.
Professor Tony LaMontagne again.
You know, without trying to go into numbers, so how do we assess that burden? One approach is, well, what percent of depression or suicide, a minimum, we would say, of 10 to 15% of suicides in the working population are attributable to working conditions. And that's a lot. But we also could take a costing approach. So, you know, you can look at the costs of mental health care, of turnover when people get mentally ill from work and then leave work. There are costs to turnover, health care, medication, lost wages. And most of what you tend to see, we've been able to do in terms of costing studies, has been around cost to employers. We don't have good figures for, well, what's the impact on a worker because of work-related ill mental health. We have no good figures there. The impacts on that family, we don't have no figures. So we're not even capturing all the costs, and they still come out huge. From our estimates, somewhere around 5 or 6% of the annual cost of depression in society would be attributable to job strain. So that tells us what we need to fix. How exactly to fix it is a lot harder.
Are there any proven or practical ways to reduce job strain, Tony?
Yeah, there are, but the evidence is patchy, and the challenge is that exactly how to improve job control for you versus me versus a convenience store clerk, a construction laborer, a primary school teacher. If for every solution needs to be context relevant. So it'll depend on whether you're in a male versus female dominated workforce, or a mixed, or a unionized versus non-unionized, or what sector you're in. All sorts of contextual factors come into play when you're devising a solution to optimize or improve job control for a given worker, and so reduce strain. For young workers, there's in principle a relatively easier solution. So for me, as that construction laborer way back when, an employer could reasonably say, well, look, I can't, a young worker, a new worker is inexperienced. How do I give them job control? They don't know what to do yet. Well, you give them good support and social support from coworkers and social support at work from supervisors moderates the impact of job strain substantially. So it's a way of controlling it. But what that means is sort of human-centered management. Have you seen a lot of that lately? Sadly, no.
What about looking out for others? So how might we look out for signs of job strain in our team members or work colleagues?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, that's a good question. So this is what most of prevalent practice is around workplace mental health and well-being. It tends to be focused on illness and on workers. So, you know, having an Are You Okay Day is good. Having an employee assistance program is a valuable thing. Having a peer support program is fantastic. But these are reactive mechanisms. So what we see in practice is that there's a relative de-emphasis on providing psychologically safe work, that is good working conditions, moderating demands, promoting control, giving people some level of job security. These things are all critical, but they tend to be underemphasized in prevalent practice. And the individual directed, you know, oh, you need a resilience class. Well, resilience is lovely, but it doesn't fix work.
So we came up with this model that we refer to as the integrated approach to workplace mental health. We came up with that model actually 10 years ago, almost to the day now. We saw in the research that work around mental health had really been happening along three strains and they hadn't actually been brought together. And Tony and I had discovered this because he was very much working on the prevent harm aspect. So he was looking at job strain, workplace health and safety, and how you can address workplace stress. For example, my area of research and some of our colleagues' area was looking more at how you can promote the positive aspects of work and how you can promote well-being.
This is Dr. Catherine Page. She worked alongside Tony, who you've just been hearing from.
I'm an organisational psychologist and researcher with an affiliation at Deakin University. And then there was a third area of research that was happening relatively separately, which was around the importance of promoting mental health literacy and, you know, how you support workers to return to work after experiencing a mental health problem. So this integrated approach essentially brings all three of these streams together under one umbrella. And in a simple way, it's around, number one, the first pillar is preventing harm. So how do we protect worker mental health by preventing the aspects of work that we know harm mental health? And job strain absolutely falls into that category. The second pillar is around how do we promote the positive aspects of work and promote worker well-being, which we know also has a very positive impact on mental health. And then the third is support workers or respond to workers who already may have a mental health problem or may already have a vulnerability to experiencing mental health problems. How do we support them to work, but also to return to work if they do have a mental health problem at work?
And over the last 10 years, Catherine's seen an improvement in how we talk about mental health at work, but she says there's something else that's still stigmatised that perhaps we're not talking about enough.
Job stress is still perceived very much as an individual weakness. So if somebody does experience stress at work, there is often then a conversation around, well, maybe that person just doesn't have the skills to cope with that. Maybe they're just not resilient enough. Maybe we've just given them more than they can handle. And when you hear people talk about that, you know, on the one hand, it's difficult because you do want people to be having conversations around workload, but we want the onus of that conversation to be, we want to be putting the onus back on workplaces to say, well, there is such a thing as sustainable levels of workload and sustainable hours, that you could take the most resilient person and put them in a really stressful job. And eventually, maybe not quickly, but absolutely eventually, they will start to be worn down no matter how high their resources are and experience the same resulting depression, anxiety as a result. So I think what we know is that many people aren't comfortable talking about feeling stressed because they don't want to be tarred with that brush, whereby people think that maybe they're just not managing their time very well, or maybe they're just not resilient. Because the last thing they want sometimes is to be, we put people in positions where they might get demoted as a result of talking about stress.
And the factors behind that stress can be multifaceted.
And almost always you will hear that there are a multitude of things happening. Yes, there's probably something happening on the personal front. So whether it be, you know, a relationship breakdown, or whether they be parents of young children, or whether there's illness in the family. But equally, there's always, almost typically, something that's happened at work that was the trigger. So maybe there was a new manager that came into the team who had a very different work style. Maybe there were mass layoffs or restructuring and an expectation of needing to do more with less. Perhaps there was a change in technology, change in resources. And then how we actually talk about that is really interesting. So you will hear organisations saying what probably is to an extent the right thing, you know, very supportive about giving that person time off from work and helping them to rehabilitate and transition back into work in a relatively low stress way. But what you don't hear workplaces talking about are the work-based causes of that. Because I think quite often we expect that the work-related causes or the work factors, that's just the minimum expectation of us. That's something we should just be able to cope with. And if something tips us over the edge, it's because life got in the way of work, not necessarily the other way around. Until we start to have quite an even-handed conversation around both sides of that model, we're not really going to be able to create the shift that we need in this space.
One strategy Catherine uses in her own team is to talk openly about stress and workloads.
So on a week-by-week basis, I might say to my team, if you were to give me a score of 1 to 10, how would you rate your current workload? And by the way, I don't expect you to be at a 10. Because we know things come up. We know that there's personal life, there's admin, there's emails, there's all sorts of things that are happening. So ideally, you'd be at a 7 or an 8. And we have conversations around workload because sometimes people are well over that. And then also sometimes people don't have enough to do on a week-by-week basis, which can also be stressful. And so we have that conversation around workload and we make changes as a group around that to make sure that we're working in a sustained way.
Let's return now to Caitlin Marshall, who we heard from at the beginning of the episode. Nowadays, she's the founder of Makeshift,
which is an organisation that works to connect creativity and creative practice with mental health education and trauma recovery. And I also work as a trainer and educator for Full Stop Australia in the area of vicarious trauma and gendered violence. So I do quite a bit of different work. With Makeshift, we ran a program working with injured workers. So they were mostly first responders who had PTSD and were no longer able to work. And we took them through a program of exploring different creative practices like play music, writing, gardening, things like that, alongside education around how our nervous system works. And that's, as a mental health educator, I think that's the biggest missing part of our understanding and literacy around mental health is the nervous system. We're not taught how that works and how we can listen to the signals that it tells us. We have kind of a framework of three types of practices for repair and protecting our mental health against workplace stress. So there's repair, they're really short, you know, going from meeting to meeting or in between calls or visits. We have recharge, they're like regular practices of self-care that need to be non-negotiable. They're part of being able to do your job and they're about restoring your nervous system into a place of being functional, grounded, in reasonable, rational thinking and problem-solving capacity. And, you know, deeper restorative practices that are all about, you know, filling yourself up at the end of the week or the end of the month.
So the three R's again, repair, recharge and restore. Now, something that Caitlin hears in the workshops for burnout prevention and vicarious trauma is people expressing shame and self-blame.
A lot of people turn it back on themselves and think, there must be something wrong with me. I'm not cut out for this. I'm not coping. And really being able to zoom out and look at, firstly, the research tells us that if these features and factors are at play, then burnout is a hazard of the workplace. Vicarious trauma is a hazard, just like on a construction site, there are physical hazards with large, giant bits of equipment. The bit I love the most is being able to really unpick that idea that this is somehow the flaw of an individual, instead of looking at the world of work that we have created and the demands that we put on people in work and then wonder why their mental health and well-being is depleted because it's almost impossible not to be in those conditions.
So, Tony, what I can't quite get my head around, though, is what happens next? So is this a conversation that a manager would have with their team members to look at how is your job designed, or does it go up to a level? Does it go up to human resources, or is it then at the industry level? Where do you think the intervention lies best?
Well, the short answer is it can happen at any and all of those levels and probably should be happening at all of those levels. What I would say to employers out there who are engaging with this, and you know, it's hard. This is hard. I sympathize with employers because we know now what to do. There's finally consensus on what to do, improve control, reduce insecurity, blah, blah, blah. But these are not easy to do. And as we develop the regulations and things in parallel with that, we need to be developing resources that help employers and workers, unions, other workplace stakeholders with how to improve control, how to moderate demands, how to reduce insecurity. And that will help us along the path towards improving workplace mental health.
Thanks to my guests, Professor Tony LaMontagne, Professor of Work, Health and Wellbeing at Deakin University, Dr. Catherine Page from Deakin University. Thanks also to Caitlin Marshall and Ryan McGrory for sharing their stories and insights. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson, mixed by Carrie Dell. In part two of our health series, we'll be talking about chronic pain at work, how one in five people are living with it, and why they're not telling their bosses about it.
Once they lose their purpose, which is their work, and often it means a heck of a lot, then they lose so much more emotionally, physically, and, you know, psychologically.
Don't miss out. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. If this episode raised any concerns for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Till next time, work it, baby.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.